Hey, Deserving listeners, over the past few months, I have been posting things about the trial, as you know, and I received a lot of emails. And about a month or so ago, I decided that I would put all those emails into a folder and that I would react to them all at once instead of piecemeal. And so I thought I would just read all the emails now and react to it. I've skimmed some of the emails or looked at the topic sentence, and I know that some of the emails are critical of me, which is fine. Some of them are very pointedly critical, and I am already feeling my heart start to race a little bit, and my hands are starting to sweat. I have a mild form of obsessive compulsive personality disorder, and people with OCPD have different triggers, and it's a very diverse personality issue. And for me, apparently a major trigger for me is when people are critical of me and I have no way of being able to have a back and forth with them. When a client, for example, you know, I specialize in people with personality disorders, and it's commonplace that I will trigger them at some point accidentally, and they will attack me and be very, very angry and very, very hurt towards me. And I specialize in that kind of thing. I welcome that kind of thing. I consider it to be a good opportunity for a lot of therapy to happen. They voice their anger and upsetness at me, and it gives me a chance to prove to them that they're worth it, that they can talk about whatever they want to, and I'm very authentic, and I will apologize. And often I did make a mistake, and they are right. But in those situations, I can have a back and forth with them, right? Like, they can be extremely angry at me, like just rageful at me. But I don't worry about that, because I have faith from experience that we can see ourselves through that. I don't think I'm going to be able to convince them of something necessarily, but I do feel confident that if we talk about it, that we can both feel, I don't know, heard and understood, and that, you know, not only can I hear them, but they can hear me. Whereas when people send emails or they comment and they're having that kind of energy with me, it's like I'm completely in a dark abyss where I can't reach out and say, can we talk about this? Like, you know, if I was giving a public lecture and someone stood up and asked me a very harsh question or said something very harsh, I'll tell you, like, it doesn't trigger me. I would say, well, let's talk about it, you know, and you're probably right. I figured this out over the past 6 months, really. I've been a therapist for 25 years. I've been in a lot of therapy, and it's taken me this long to know that what underlies that trigger for me. And it's taken all this time for me to figure out why I get so triggered by people not like, I mean, I can get triggered by a small negative comment because of the reasons I said. So I'm already feeling it. I don't know if you can hear it in my voice, like the nervousness, the fear response, the adrenaline is already going, because I'm like, I don't know. Okay, so it's like, all right. And part of this, I might even consider it to be part of my therapy, I suppose, to have some sort of exposure to the stimulus and you know, really just feel it and know that I'm still safe, because that's essentially what's happening in my body, is that I feel like I'm about to die, or someone's about to shove me down a hole or something. I don't know. So I will use my emotional regulation techniques as I do this. So let's read an email here. Anonymous upper tier patron says, "Dear Dr. Honda, this will be my very last email. Some of us did not care about this trial. Some of us did not want to be dragged into a very triggering topic for months. Some did not want to see the voice they had come to trust, who had championed compassion and reason in regards to personality disorders, become what we see now." So I think what Anonymous Upper Tier Patron is saying, that they trusted me regarding personality disorders, and now they don't trust me anymore, and I've been dragging them into a triggering topic for months. "You have become a person who double talks in every video. This is what we saw our abusers do. Even ones who profess to love us and care greatly about being seen as a good person, just like you do, just like our abuser used to do to us, you do not care about us." So let me understand this. "You have become a person who double talks in every video." Double talks. So I'm guessing that's a reference to how I would try to see things from both sides. I'm not sure. always speculative. This is what we saw our abusers do. So they saw their abusers double talk. Yeah, that happens. And so I could see how, I guess, how that would trigger people. Even ones who profess to love us and cared greatly about being seen as a good person, just like you do, I don't know what they're referring to there, just like our abuser used to do to us, you do not care about us. I have to disagree. I do care greatly about you. I care about humans in general, but particularly people that I have interacted with who I've gotten to know and have heard their stories and understand that we're all in this together. But anyway, some of us instinctively felt how wrong and scary the Law YouTube channels are. Some of us instinctively felt how wrong and scary the Law YouTube channels are. Yes, I know you love them now. That is apparent. But some of us know this type of group mentality. So just chiming in here, I don't know what you're talking about. Law YouTube channel? Are you talking about that one channel that I was on? I will say that in the beginning of me reacting to the trial, I was getting a lot of DMs and emails asking to come on other podcasts and YouTube channels. And I didn't go on all of them, but some of them I did, because I, one, am trying to spread information to combat misinformation about borderline and histrionic and psychology and intimate partner violence. I can feel my heart start to race again. Emotional regulation. Relax the shoulders. You're safe. You're on the ground. Everything's okay. Okay, so, and this one channel reached out, and it was a Law YouTube channel, I think, I don't know, and they asked me to come on, and I went on because, you know, I guess I did a little bit of, and I always do a little bit of investigation just to kind of see what their thing is, and I can't profess to the integrity of the Law YouTube channel that I was on, but I did a little bit. It's not like I, you know, if there was like some kind of right-wing Law YouTube channel, if I thought that I might be able to affect their listeners in some way, I might still go on. But anyway, so there were people afterwards that I went on that channel that were attacking me, and I don't use attack lightly. Like there's criticism, and we'll get into it as we start to go through these emails. There's people that will say, I think you're wrong about this. That's fine. Or I think you missed something here. How come you missed that? It seems kind of irresponsible to miss that. And I'd be like, okay, I was kind of discombobulated throughout the whole thing, honestly. So did I miss something? Sure. So I don't use the word attack lightly. And maybe there will be some emails along those lines. I tried to keep out the major ones. Again, I skimmed the emails to just kind of, anyway, after I was on that one YouTube channel, it was a live stream, I believe, and people started emailing me and commenting and saying that I was a terrible person. You know, there are people that were criticizing, which is fine, but there are people who were attacking me saying I'm a terrible human being and that I'm causing trouble in the world and I'm damaging themselves. And the things that I remember them saying was that this YouTube channel was involved in some questionable behavior. I don't want to make stuff up, but if I remember, because this was a few months ago, if I remember right, people were saying that they were selling some sort of merch that was disrespectful to DV survivors or something like that. And when I saw that, I thought, huh, yeah, that's pretty questionable. Why would they do that? Aren't they lawyers? They're attorneys. Like, they're not some sort of shock jock on YouTube, right? So that seems unusual. I didn't look into it because, I don't know, I just didn't have time. Or I might have looked into it and couldn't find anything. Or actually, no, I remember I did email the attorney that is in charge of that YouTube channel. And I said, did you know that some people are saying you're doing this? I think I did that. And I don't remember what she said. But anyway, the point is that people were pointing that out, and I was like, huh, you know, yeah, interesting. I mean, I'm thinking you should talk to them. I was just a guest on their channel. Like, do you think we all sit around? I mean, anyway. But the attacking of me, somehow that I was complicit in some awful movement against survivors and against women or something. And I don't remember anyone attacking me for what I said. They were just attacking me for being... So anyway, so some of us instinctively felt how wrong and scary the law YouTube... I don't want to come across as defensive, by the way. So I don't want this whole episode to be me just defending myself. So some of us are instinctively felt how wrong and scary the law YouTube channels were. Okay. I don't know anything about that. Yes, I know you love them now. That is apparent. It's apparent that I love all the law... Where did that happen? Like... I've had attorneys on my podcast, but they were listeners or patrons of the podcast, people that were emailing with me, and they don't have YouTube channels, so I don't know. So going on, it is part of our abuse, and you do not see it. You profess to be so ahead of and superior to mainstream media. Sure you are. You have none of the ethical standards. You truly feel so highly of yourself. I see. So that's, I think, what this earlier sentence, this is what our abusers did to us, even ones who professed to love us and cared greatly about being seen as a good person. So it had a hint of narcissism accusation there, but I think this is where we are now hearing more explicit accusation. So again, you profess to be so ahead of and superior to mainstream media. I pray to God that I did not come across as if I was claiming to be superior or ahead of mainstream media. What I was saying in those episodes was that a lot of people were telling me, and then I was kind of noticing, but I was mainly basing this, well, I was half basing it on my own experience, but I would never have said anything based on my experience because what do I know? But a lot of people were telling me that there was this huge divide between mainstream media and non-mainstream media, in that mainstream media, especially during the trial, seemed to be very on the surface and still kind of in the camp that Amber Heard was telling the truth and that Johnny Depp was an abuser. And most people online were starting to have a lot more nuance to it. Let's just say that. I'm not saying that Amber Heard wasn't a victim by any means. I never said that, right? So I was saying that I, as a part of literally millions of other non-mainstream media content providers, had a different, seemingly more in-depth point of view, but superior, I guess by definition, I'm saying that we were superior as a group, but I wouldn't say I am superior to mainstream media. You know, like I'm superior to the New York Times or literally any newspaper, I mean, or any news channel. I'm not superior to them at all. And then you say I have none of the ethical standards. So ethics, I could go into the weeds on that. I actually published my episode, my deep dive on the ethical standards, the ethical considerations for clinicians going on social media. Because a few years ago, I started to supervise people that were also in the media and much more famous than I was, in fact, which isn't hard to believe, but, you know, very, very famous influencers, these kinds of people. And I had developed over the years an ethical system for reducing the risk to my clients and my students, my supervisees, and the public. And I had cobbled that together over 10 or, you know, 12 years or something. But I had never had to teach it to someone else. And when I'm a supervisor, I have to monitor everything they're doing. And so I couldn't download my thinking process into their heads, so I had to write it out. And as I was writing it out, well, actually, it began with me asking my supervisees to write it out because I didn't want to do the work. I was just like, you know, do the research, look up the articles, write up a piece for me, and prove to me that you understand the ethics regarding the fact that you're on social media and how to guide your behavior. And the papers that they submitted were insufficient in my eyes, which makes sense given how complicated it was and how little they knew about it. So I didn't criticize them. What I did was I was like, okay, I'm going to write a piece. And then as I started writing it, it became this deep dive that I went down for months because there was just so much to talk about. And it became like this white paper that I believe is on my website. And I really went into the weeds regarding the ethical standards of people like me being on social media. And unless someone has a specific accusation about my behavior as a therapist, a clinician, and a supervisor and educator, then I don't know what to say. I will say that I think about it all the time, and I consider it frequently, and I've done the research, and I've looked into all the different risks and possibilities, and I developed this paper. So if anyone ever has a specific allegation or even just a question like, you did this, I kind of feel like that might be unethical, I would be more than happy to field that question because I have spent a lot of time looking into that. So when people, and it's not very often when people say I'm being unethical, but I just have to say, you know, do you have a specific allegation? Because maybe I did make a mistake. Things happen. But anyway, this person says, I have none of the ethical standards of, I think, mainstream media. And then they say, you truly feel so highly of yourself. So saying that I'm narcissistic. And recently, people were trying to figure out aspects of my personal life on Reddit and the Facebook fan page. And people were alerting me to that. The moderators were saying, did you know that your fans are trying to investigate your life and they're trying to figure out aspects of your personal life? How do you feel about that? And at first I'm like, well, you know, people are curious. When I listen to a podcast, I'm curious. If they mention their partner, I'll Google them and say, you know, what do they look like? And who are they? And so, you know, it's fine. And there's public information. But these people, some of them were getting into my friend's Facebook accounts. And because if they're a friend of mine on Facebook, then they have access to pictures. And you know what I mean? And so it felt invasive and icky to me. And so I sent a post. I made a post and I was just like, look, I totally get that you're curious. And some people were saying that I might not be as credible because they don't know certain aspects of my life that I talk about. Anyway, point is that I, at the time, what felt pressure from the listeners to be more disclosing about my personal life, about me as a human being. And I've disclosed a lot, by the way. But, you know, there's a certain boundary there, not only because I want to be ethical as a therapist for my current clients and my students and my supervisees, because if they know everything about me, then it can interfere with treatment, you know, in a number of ways, which I won't go into. But also, I'm kind of private about some things. And so I just don't feel comfortable about disclosing those things. But anyway, I felt pressure to be more disclosing. And I thought, well, maybe I will. And I don't know. I wasn't getting much support from people around me even saying that the boundaries were viable or valid or something. So I kind of felt alone in my boundary around that. I felt okay about it, but I just felt like alone. But anyway, I, a long time ago, mentioned that I am on the narcissistic spectrum. I think I said I was something like 5% on the spectrum. And I talked about my tendencies and my therapy and why it's there and my vulnerabilities around that. And when I hear comments like this, because this person's a longtime listener, I'm guessing that they've heard me talk about that. It makes me be extremely wary of disclosing anything about me because it clearly will be used against me. So, you know, and another thing that I saw along these lines was I talked about my MAPI score, which is extremely personal, right? I was doing it for your benefit. And, you know, the vast majority of you either were neutral or appreciated it. But some people were online as a coalition using that information that I provided in the MAPI as a way of trying to take my license away. And one, I think I might have even said this in another video, I'm like, one, it's not a valid test. And I talked about that because I administered it on myself and interpreted it myself. So that's not a valid personality test. Two, it was conducted 12 years ago or something. So this doesn't reflect who I am today in all likelihood. It might be, but who knows? Three, nothing I said in the disclosures that I provided to the internet indicates anything about me that would make me a menace to society in the least. In fact, every single one of my scores were within normal limits. The way that Dr. Hughes interprets it, you know, Dr. Hughes has the cutoff at 65 and below that it's normal, and all mine were normal. four or whatever number I'm on, even if the test indicated that I did have psychopathy or something, which it didn't, then that doesn't mean I'm a bad therapist. There are plenty of therapists that are doing good work, ethical work, and they score high on those scales, and they've been diagnosed with psychopathy or narcissism or something like that. It's a false notion that somehow if you've been diagnosed with a personality disorder, it means that you're not a good therapist. It's just not true. Some of our most prized psychologists and researchers and therapists in our field have disclosed that they were diagnosed with personality disorders like borderline and narcissism and those kinds of things. And these people are very revered. So there's that. Five, or again, whatever number I'm on, just because someone has an elevation on a scale, which I didn't, does not mean they have the disorder, because no one diagnoses from the MPI alone. So anyway, it just makes me be extremely scared and terrified of revealing anything about myself, because clearly there are people, I don't think it's a valid attack, but I don't know, it just feels terrifying, you know, that I would disclose something about myself like that. And when I'm disclosing those things, I am scared that it will be used against me or misinterpreted or something. But I do those things because I trust the public, which apparently is misguided. So anyway, I'm angry about it. Okay, relax. So you truly feel so highly of yourself. So a little bit more on that. Yeah, I do have a problem with that. And it undoubtedly comes through as a podcaster, and I'm not proud of it, and it's mortifying to think about. I hate that about myself. I wish I could get rid of it. I've worked really hard in therapy for 25 years, and it was one of the first things I started working on when I was 24 in therapy. And I've come to terms with the fact that I have a tendency in a certain way at times, you know? Like one of the things is that, much to, I think, my wife's lamenting, I will yammer at her. You know, I yammer to y'all, and when I turn off the camera and we're at dinner or something, like, you know, I'm talking all the time, and she's, you know, politely listening, but probably not enthralled all the time. And, you know, it's part of me being on that spectrum. And it's terrible. But anyway, and now I feel like, why am I disclosing more? Like, what's wrong with me? I know what's wrong with me. I know what's wrong with, or I think I know what's wrong with me. Anyway, they go on to say, I never asked for this. I never asked to be disrespectfully dragged unwillingly into the mud with you. It never should have happened, ever. Boundaries, just the word boundaries as a sentence. So I don't know what they mean by boundaries. Dragging unwilling people, I've always had the philosophy for the past number of years, because most podcasters and frankly YouTube channels, they have like one episode a week, you know, maybe one episode every couple days or something. But early on, I said, if I have the time, I actually want to, there's so much to talk about, but I don't expect anyone to absorb all the content. Even back before, when I wasn't doing any YouTube videos really, and I was only putting out three episodes a week, I thought, well, no one's going to listen to three episodes a week. That's too much content. But I thought, if there's a lot of stuff out there, people can kind of pick and choose what they want to listen to and not listen to stuff they don't want to listen to. And so I've always thought that if you didn't want to watch the trial stuff that I do or listen to those episodes, then you just wouldn't. I would fully expect that to happen. There's just no way you could humanly listen to all the stuff that I put out there. So to say that you were disrespectfully dragged unwillingly through the mud on this trial, I guess I just should have said, hey, don't listen to this if you don't want to, or you think it's going to harm you in some way. Well, I feel like I do say that in terms of trigger warnings, but I guess not specifically around this sort of angle anyway. But the person goes on to say, I listened for 4 years. I commented hundreds of times on your content. I just feel so very stupid now that I did that. I know I am not the only one, and I am glad to know that. I just had no words for the level of cluelessness I saw in you. So first off, I hope you don't feel stupid. I mean, that's awful that you would feel stupid. You're not stupid. You just don't like what I'm saying, I guess. And I guess I think your vibe is that you trusted me and that I hurt you. And I'm having that adrenaline feeling again. If you were a friend of mine or a client of mine or a student of mine, we could talk about this. I'm not confident necessarily I'd be able to change your mind, but I would be confident that I could make you feel like I hear you. That's literally my profession, to authentically, in my heart, open myself up to these kinds of messages to me. So maybe that would help my OCPD if I imagined you in front of me and I was just like, I hear you. I'm with you. I get it. I don't know if I understand it completely, but I see that you're disappointed in me and that you felt you could trust me. You opened up to me and then I hurt you, which makes you feel like you're stupid, which you're not. It was good of you to open yourself up to other people, including me, I guess. I don't know if it was warranted to me, but it's a good thing to try to open yourself up to people that you think are going to be safe. And you thought I was going to be safe, and you had data for that. And then I provided data that you think you're not safe with me. And when I say that out loud, that is quite possibly one of the worst things I could ever think I could ever do. Which, when I think of that, I'm just like, why am I here? Why am I doing this? I think I said in another video, people will say, you know, with my YouTube channel, if I can just save one person's life, if I can just touch one person, then it's all worth it. Well, as a glass half empty point of view, which is kind of what I have, is if I harm one person with my content, then it's not worth it to me. I mean, that's how I feel about it. I don't think that's very rational, given that, I don't know. I don't know if that's rational, but that's how much this means to me. You know, even if I don't agree with you, I understand how these things feel. And that's why I am so, I think, careful and usually precise about how I word things and about what I say. I edited all those trial videos heavily. Usually in other episodes, I just sort of put it out. If me and Bob are talking, I just sort of put it out because I figure, yeah, that's probably fine. But these videos, we touch on so many sensitive topics. I was extremely careful, and yet I still hurt some people. And I, on one hand, say, well, I guess you can't make an omelet without breaking eggs. But on the other hand, I'm just like, well, I could have been more careful. I think I could have tried harder, provided more caveats, or I don't know. I don't know what I could have done, but I clearly didn't do enough. And there's a chance that it wasn't humanly possible to do enough, but it's also possible and likely and probable that I could have done more, and I didn't do that. I tried. I'll tell you, I tried, but maybe I could have tried harder, or maybe I just shouldn't have done it at all. And those are all worthy criticisms, and I hear you. So I'll tell you, as I envision you there, which I don't even know if you are there because you probably aren't listening to my podcast anymore, but if I think about you there, I feel so much more regulated. I have to tell you, even if you were to look at me and say like, well, I think you're stupid, I guess I would feel at least that you had a chance to hear me and for me to demonstrate that I care, because I do. So that makes me feel better that maybe you're out there hearing it and maybe you at least heard it. You know, you could think that I'm trying to manage other people's impressions of me, I guess, in a narcissistic way. I suppose that's one counter to this whole thing that could invalidate literally everything I do. So that's the first email, and I think there are dozens, so this is going to take a while. Cassandra from Boston says, Dear Dr. Honda, I'm very sorry to hear you've been subjected to online bullying. Personally, I've really appreciated your empathy in examining the trial. Your even-handed coverage reminds me that it's important to have empathy, perhaps especially towards people who feel strongly have done a bad thing and acted wrongly. Some of the other YouTube psychologists I follow have suggested that borderline personality disorder alone does not explain Amber's actions in lying the way she did. For example, the armchair psychologist and Todd Grande. They have suggested that she must be a narcissist as well, and these diagnoses tend to be gendered. Can you explain the difference between these two disorders? Is it possible that Amber has both disorders, both borderline and narcissism? If not, why would she lie about something that has such a hurtful effect on someone she claims to love? End of question. Yeah, good question, and thanks for the support, by the way. One, I'm not a huge fan of the word narcissist, because 90%+ of the time when I hear anyone say that person's a narcissist and I ask them what they mean by that, usually it's psychopathy or antisocial personality is what I'm hearing them describe to me. So the word that person is a narcissist, I'm always like, I don't know what people were saying if they were saying that the behavior was because she's a narcissist. Are they saying narcissistic personality? The other thing is most people don't understand. In fact, research shows that us as clinicians, a large percentage, I can't remember the data, something like 50% of us are incompetent at understanding and diagnosing narcissistic personality disorder, even though a lot of people think they can diagnose it and they feel like they can understand it, but they don't. So it's complicated is the thing. But yeah, it's totally true that borderline and narcissistic personality disorder are gendered. For example, if you took the exact same presentation and presented it to a room of clinicians, and in one group you said, this is a woman, she would likely be diagnosed with borderline. And in another group you said, this is a man, he would likely be diagnosed with narcissistic personality disorder, even though it's the exact same presentation. Because we can't get out of sexism and bias and socialization regarding what genders, the differences and all that kind of stuff. And so, yes, the exact same presentation can be seen as narcissism or borderline, depending on the gender of the client. Also, in the research, they will say, well, 2/3 of people with narcissism are men and 2/3 of people with borderline are women. But when we actually do research, and it's not fully fleshed out yet, but I believe this is accurate based on my anecdotal experience, is that when you actually eliminate the bias around gender, meaning that you actually just take the gender away from the presentation, then what we see is that the percentages are much more equal, if not equal, meaning that among people with narcissistic personality, all genders are represented equally, and among people with borderline, all genders are represented equally. But I understand this because, similar to intimate partner violence, we don't talk about certain gender configurations in intimate partner violence, and we also don't talk about certain genders when it comes to narcissistic personality disorder or borderline personality disorder. The vast majority of case examples of borderline are women examples, and the vast majority of narcissistic examples are male examples. So it's hard to picture it in our mind because it's so rarely discussed, in the same way that it's, for some people, hard to imagine a woman being an abuser and a man being a victim because it's so rarely talked about or depicted. And, you know, so I get that. And all that trickles down to us clinicians, that culture trickles down to us clinicians and makes it hard for us to see what's going on. Having said all that, I will say that I didn't see any evidence of narcissistic personality disorder in Johnny Depp, but that doesn't mean that there isn't evidence because we don't know anything about him. I mean, very little was presented about his personality and very little was revealed about it. Amber Heard, however, a lot of data, not only multiple psychological evaluations that were detailed quite extensively, but also just the way that she presents and the way that she talks. It's very out there, if you will. Johnny Depp is much more reserved, maybe by design, I don't know, but it's possible that he has narcissism. The other thing is to understand is that narcissism, borderline, these are not concrete things. These are not concrete categories like hydrogen and oxygen. These are concrete things. They're not literally concrete, but they are distinct things. Someone cannot look at hydrogen gas and say, well, in my opinion, that's oxygen, because it's just not. But we as clinicians can and often do look at the same individual and diagnose completely differently, clearly, as we saw by Dr. Hughes and Dr. Curry. But that's even true in non-adversarial psychological evaluations. You know, when I'm a part of a treatment team and we consult about cases, there will be disagreement, but it doesn't really matter because it's more important that the treatment actually help the issue. It's more important that that happens than actually having the exact correct label for it. The analogy that I've always said is, and maybe this is outdated at this point because I'm so old, but I've always said that the question that I would hear when I was younger was, are the Beastie Boys rap or are they rock? I'm guessing a lot of you younger people are like, who are the Beastie Boys? I don't know. Anyway, so are the Beastie Boys rap or rock? And it depends, right? Because you'll find that people will be very passionate. People will be like, oh, they're absolutely rap. Are you kidding me? I mean, they're 80s stuff. Totally rap. Other people are like, have you heard actual rap? That's not rap. They're rock. If anything, they're kind of punk rock in some way. And both are right. So it depends on your definition, and it also depends on what data you look at. And there's no scientific way to prove that the Beastie Boys are rap or rock. There just isn't. It depends on your definition. And our definitions of both things are socially constructed, and there's variability in culture regarding the definition of that. And that definition changes over time. And it's the same in my field. The definition of borderline and narcissism, the understanding of it, changes over time. So does someone have narcissism? Does someone have borderline? It's up to us to have that opinion, but it's not a concrete thing. So could someone say that Johnny Depp has narcissism and based on their definition and the data that they're paying attention to, they would be right? Yes. Now, getting to the matter at hand, I think, that they're talking about, which is why would Amber Heard lie? Well, one, we don't know if she's lying, but if she is lying, then why would someone lie like that? Well, there's no diagnosis for lying. Lying, everyone does. All of us, you have lied, I have lied. It's just a matter of extreme or circumstance. And again, that's a lot of opinion. It's a lot of clinical opinion that goes into that, right? So what I'm hearing, and I don't know if this is true, is that other YouTube people were saying that because Amber Heard was lying, which they're assuming she's lying, that means that she has narcissism and not borderline and not histrionic, I guess. And what I'll say is like, okay, if that's your opinion, but usually when we see lying and we take all of the behavior that we saw from Amber Heard, we wouldn't go towards narcissistic. We would go towards histrionic. Now, it's true that borderline individuals aren't known for lying, honestly. They could lie, I guess, like anyone else could, but that's not a hallmark of it. Histrionic, however, it is a hallmark of it. Not everyone with histrionic lies, in the same way that not every person with histrionic is very seductive in their movements and their clothing and their talk and this kind of thing. That's a subset of histrionic, but that is a hallmark of that subset. And the lying behavior is also a hallmark of that subset of individuals with histrionic. It's not a hallmark of any subset of borderline. Narcissism, not really either. Could lying emerge from some subset of narcissism? Absolutely. But psychopaths and any social people, yes, a hallmark of those individuals is that they will lie. So when I hear someone saying Amber Heard isn't borderline, she's a narcissist, I wonder if they meant psychopath, because those people do lie. And they're well known for that. But as I've been saying throughout the entire series of videos, there's some evidence of borderline and very little evidence of histrionic, because the trial isn't there to present us with all the data that Dr. Curry and Dr. Hughes saw. So I don't know if she has histrionic, but I did use it as a jumping off point to talk about histrionic occasionally. There was much more data to have a jumping off point to talk about borderline, of course. So why would she lie if she did lie? I don't know. But based on Dr. Curry's assessment of histrionic, that would be my best guess, but it's hard to know, of course. Okay, so listener Pear wrote in and gives a lot of detail here, lots of different details about the trial, trying to educate me, I guess, which I appreciate, so thanks for that, but I won't detail that because it's long. Then goes on here, in the UK, the judge put extreme weight on Johnny Depp's substance abuse and basically put away his testimony as being non-credible. This is most likely why he was so reluctant to be honest about the extent of his drug use. Okay, yeah, that's interesting. I'd heard that, but I don't think I knew it at the time of talking about those things. But yeah, that would make sense that Johnny Depp would be hesitant about talking about his drug use. I also, at the time, was hypothesizing that he still hasn't really recovered yet and is minimizing because of that. But it's probably more likely that he was trying to strategize regarding the trial. But I think it did hurt his credibility, to me anyway. Ultimately, not in the end, obviously, to the jury. But Amber Heard alleged she was abused by her past partner before Johnny Depp, who she was arrested committing domestic violence against. Yeah, I heard that. She also alleged that Elon Musk abused her and was bugging her cars. I didn't know that. And Amber Heard's bloody lip is obviously a chapped lip after pulling off a scab. It's obviously a chapped lip. For bias purposes, I will admit that Johnny Depp was jealous, not to the extent that she claims, but he did not appreciate her having multiple sex scenes, nude scenes, and going to parties on her own, etc. Knowing what we know now, I don't think his jealousy was misplaced. Wait, so what are you saying? I will admit that Johnny Depp was jealous, not to the extent she claims, but he did not appreciate her having multiple sex scenes. She's an actor, so that's going to happen. So him not appreciating it is you know, that doesn't give him the excuse to be jealous or to attack her or try to control her. I don't know if those things happened, but, and then he did not appreciate her having nude scenes. Again, she's at work. He did not appreciate her going to parties on her own. She can't go to parties on her own. Knowing what we know now, I don't think his jealousy was misplaced. Maybe I'm misunderstanding what you're saying, but I don't. I'll just move on. He certainly did not fit a profile of sexually abusing her. Okay. Yeah, I heard a number of people saying this, and although it's kind of true for sure, but that doesn't mean it didn't happen. Plenty of people don't fit the profile and commit these kinds of crimes. Now, is it easy to dismiss her stories of abuse along those lines, given all the testimony and the evidence demonstrating that she likely was lying at times, if not a lot of times? Yeah. Could you dismiss it? Sure. Is there a lot of evidence pointing in another direction, given the fact that he had never had an allegation before and doesn't fit certain quintessential profiles of an abuser, of a sexual abuser? Yeah. But again, that doesn't mean that it doesn't happen. I've treated people who did not fit the profile of someone who abuses someone sexually and did not have a history of it, apparently, and did do those kinds of behaviors. So it doesn't mean that it didn't happen. But could you conclude that you don't think it happens? Yeah. But none of us know if those things happened or not. I just want to be clear. There's no possible way that any of us outside of Johnny Depp and Amber Heard could possibly know if her account is true or not about those particular behaviors. There are other things you could point to and be like, it's extremely unlikely. So none of us know. But you could viably conclude that it didn't happen, but none of us know. We just don't. Like, that's just a fact. That's a scientific fact that none of us know. I don't know why I have to say that. It just seems so obvious, right? But I don't want to be defensive. So listen, read the emails. Johnny Depp's drug use was extensive, but none of his medical records suggest he ever went to the extent of delusion, aggressive acts, or couldn't control his anger, etc. Okay, so his drug use was extensive, but none of his medical records suggest he ever... Well, there wouldn't be a medical record because he didn't go to the physician to talk about those kinds of things in all likelihood. But is it possible that he was never delusional? Yeah, I wasn't there, and neither were you. So it was just Amber Heard's account. Could absolutely be a lie? Could have absolutely happened. Who knows? But the fact that there's no medical records doesn't say anything. And it's one of those things that there's enough evidence to suggest that it's possible, given what he was using and the extent that he was using. There's evidence that it didn't happen. And certainly there's a lot of reasons to believe that even if he did have psychosis as a result of the drug use, that he didn't do the kinds of things that Amber Heard was accusing him of. Yeah, it's possible. But yeah, I get your point. There's no medical record. You know, it's a tick in the column. It's one of the hundreds of ticks in the various columns regarding if it happened or not. You go on to say, you get a lot of negative comments, some deserved and some that are delusional and rude by trolls and triggered individuals. The reason for both are the same. You draw inferences that are not there or are easily refuted by facts in evidence. You misrepresent testimony and evidence that are available for all to see online. Your opinion of the outcome is not based in reality. That's why you get hate, and it is deserved. Wow, that took a turn at the end there. Wow, I mean, ouch. So not only do you know of the attacks, but it's deserved. Yeah, ouch. I don't know. So my opinion is not based in reality, and I deserve the bullying, and I misrepresent testimony. I mean, on its face, yeah, I'm sure I did, because that's not what I'm here to do. Like, there are people out there that know about these kinds of things and have studied it and are experts. I was reacting to the trial, so maybe I should have said that at the beginning of every video. Like, if you're coming here for an accurate representation of the data in this trial, I tell you, this isn't the place to watch, because I'm not setting out to do that. That's never been my intention with any of the things that I watch, because how would I know? The only way I could possibly represent the evidence accurately is if, I don't know, I was there or something, or if I was involved in the case somehow. But just watching stuff on YouTube, like, how would we possibly know anything? But yeah, did I make mistakes about the testimony? Yeah, I made numerous mistakes about the testimony. There were so many details to keep track of. And particularly if you're a super fan of I'm going to, it's a weird thing to say, but there are super fans of the Johnny Depp Amber Heard conflict. People that have memorized entire sections, or if not everything, about the trial. And it watching me, could that be painful because you know a lot more than me? Yeah, okay. But it means I deserve to be bullied and attacked. I mean, maybe you're right. I don't know. It's demoralizing, honestly. Okay, you knew this was going to happen. all right. Everything's fine. In a couple months, no one will even remember I watched the trial and it will all be over. Daria from Canada says, I read from a psychologist that borderline personality disorder and histrionic personality disorder are oppressive and outdated diagnoses of women, and no psychologist should ever be working in those terminologies. Can you comment on that? Yeah, they're not outdated. I understand that some people would think of them as outdated or they don't like them. And there has been a growing movement in our field to change the language in the DSM away from borderline and histrionic personality disorder and more toward the language of spectra. And I appreciate and agree with the premise, but the model that they have proposed, just doesn't resonate with me. I mean, maybe someone would have to really explain it to me somehow to make me fully understand what they're trying to get at. But yeah, has borderline and histrionic been used to oppress people? Yeah, I mean, everything in the DSM has been used to oppress people in really horrific ways. I mean, if you understand the history of my field, there's been atrocities that we have committed as a field, and big and small. And currently, are there people being oppressed and harmed, women in particular, by the labels of borderline and histrionic? Yes, it is happening. I talk with those people frequently as a lightning rod for those kinds of disorders, meaning that they will tell me their stories and I will try to raise awareness that this is happening. And yeah, absolutely. I will hear from fellow clinicians, people of all genders, by the way, that, oh, I have this client. Oh my gosh, she's so borderline. I mean, you know, because she sued her past therapist. Oh my gosh, she's so borderline. Like, I can't wait to get rid of her. And I'm not even joking. Like, that is an accurate representation of the crap that I will hear from fellow clinicians. And when I'm in power, I will come down hard on that. Hard. I'll be nice, but firm. If it's a boss, do I say something? Now I would, but in the past when I didn't have any power and didn't even necessarily know I was right, I don't know if I would say something. I certainly would bite my tongue a lot. If it's a peer and a colleague, I might say something depending on if I feel safe enough. And I probably dropped the ball many times and should have said something but didn't because I didn't know if I should say something. I worried it would come out as condescending to them or something. But anyway, so yes, it's absolutely used to oppress people. It's not outdated because it's literally in the most, you know, recent version of the DSM that just came out this year. And you go on to say, and if a person isn't supposed to be diagnosed with this because it is outdated, then what is the diagnosis instead? Well, again, it's not outdated. I actually have spoken out about this for a long time, that I don't like the word histrionic. The label, the word, originated from ancient Greece, meaning uterus, you know, like a hysterectomy. Histrionic, it has the same base because originally, 4,000 years ago, even prior to the ancient Greeks in ancient Egypt, there was this notion that when some people, particularly women, had a whole variety of symptoms, I could list all this, it's literally hundreds of symptoms that do not hold together, but lots of different symptoms. I mean, it was 4,000 years ago. Medical science wasn't what it is today. But they would label that whatever the ancient Egyptians called it. But the concept was that the uterus was wandering throughout the body. I'm not even joking. And then the ancient Greeks took some of their medical knowledge from the ancient Egyptians and they adopted that. And then they applied their word for uterus called hysteria or histrionic, right? I mean, it's probably a different sort of conjugation of the word back then. Those ideas were adopted by medicine in Europe, and then eventually by the time psychology and psychotherapy and psychoanalysis came around, we still had this word hysteria. In fact, Freud's first seminal work had to do with hysteria. And over the past 140 years since Freud wrote about it in 1880, we have slowly evolved and morphed and changed. Our current conceptualization of hysteria or histrionic is vastly different than Freud's version back 142 years ago. But it has its roots in that, and we just kept holding on to that word of histrionic. I think partially because it's so old and it comes from Freud. But to call Amber Heard histrionic, like there's something wrong with her uterus, is inherently sexist, right? And hysteria has been used in all sorts of sexist ways throughout our history in our field and the field of medicine. And just even the non-clinical word of hysterical has been used against women. Women who are crying for valid reasons because they're being harmed or oppressed by misogyny or sexism will be labeled as being hysterical. Oh, you're hysterical. You know? And yeah, so I wish we would get away from the word histrionic. There's no reason why we need to hold on to that word. I don't know what word we would replace it with, but something like attention trauma would fit for me. I don't know. Now, the word borderline does make some sense, though, but it's a little harsh because it refers back to the original observations of people with borderline as being borderline psychotic, because people at the upper end of borderline personality disorder are slightly delusional at times. When they're triggered, they will see rejection and betrayals that did not happen, and they will hear things that, but it's not a hallucination. They're just filtering their experiences through their emotion and coding their memories to fit with their emotion rather than what really happened. We all do this, but people with borderline do it to a greater extent. And so they will believe things that happened, you know, truly believe, you said this to me 5 minutes ago, and you're like, what are you, I did not say anything of the sort to you. And they're convinced and they're angry about it. And that's, you could label that delusional, but it's not really a delusion. It's borderline delusional. But borderline delusional as the label focuses on one aspect of the borderline condition that is just a small part. In fact, I would guess that a good number, a good sizable percentage of people with borderline don't have those experiences of borderline delusions. So a better word for me would be abandonment trauma personality disorder. It'll never happen, I don't think, in my lifetime anyway. But now, the labels of borderline and histrionic are extremely helpful for experts, for people that actually know what borderline is and know what histrionic is. The history of the label, we don't really hear that anymore. We just use the word itself, and it doesn't carry with it that stigma, because experts know the stigma and have debunked all of those myths in their mind. So experts of borderline and histrionic do not think of people with borderline and histrionic as bad people or having anything to do with the uterus or having anything to do with gender. So experts, yes, there are many in my field who are not experts in any personality disorder, let alone borderline and histrionic, that still will have a lot of the stigma and still will not know what they're doing and still will have a lot of myths about those disorders. So can one clinician look at other clinicians and go like, we have a problem here, we got to get rid of it? And I'm like, whoa, like, yes, there's a problem, but we need to educate people more. But honestly, if we change the labels, I don't care, because I don't use those labels with my clients anyway. Typically I use, and I would frequently use this phrasing in my videos, of all my videos, all my episodes, I don't tend to talk about borderline as borderline. I tend to talk about it as abandonment trauma or betrayal trauma or relational traumas. You'll hear me say that. I'm not saying that as a euphemism. I'm saying it because it's a much more precise label. It's a much more meaningful label. It's much more descriptive, right? Saying something, someone has borderline, I don't know what people think of borderline. In fact, most people have very negative, you know, wrong points of view about borderline. So I use more precise language because then I can be reassured that people will know what I'm talking about. But if I talk to a fellow expert, I know I can use the word borderline. I know that they will know what I mean because we've previously talked about it, and I know that they're an expert in it. Okay, anonymous patron, she says, some commentators think people might be getting triggered by you because you advocate for the emotional struggles for the person with borderline personality disorder, but they want to hear you advocate for the struggling family members of people with borderline and the struggles for the abuse victims of borderline. How does one cope or survive if you are in a relationship with someone with borderline, particularly if you are the child and it's the parent with borderline? Interesting. I don't think I'd ever considered that, but it makes total sense that people would be triggered by me, because people have been triggered by me in the past around this. That, because I've been talking about borderline, various different personality disorders, but a lot on borderline for the past 14 years of this podcast. And occasionally people would email in and they would say something like that. They'd be like, hey, you know, thanks for providing detailed information about borderline personality disorder, but I feel like you're advocating for compassion for these people, which I guess is good. But what if the person in my life that has borderline was massively abusive to me? Am I supposed to have compassion for them? You know, for the abuser? Are we blaming the victims? And that did not occur to me, which is kind of obvious to think about, right? And so I would do episodes where I would counter that. And I would say, yes, absolutely. People with borderline can abuse other people. People with narcissism can abuse other people, and it can be horrific. It can be awful. It can be some of the worst abuse that you've ever heard about can be committed by someone who has borderline or narcissistic and or histrionic for that matter. So yeah, that needs to be said. And I apparently didn't, or I'm guessing I didn't say that enough, and I should have, particularly for the new people watching me. I mean, it just mortifies me to think about new people. And of course I knew a lot of new people were watching, but it didn't occur to me to say that. I wish I could go back in time and say certain caveats or sprinkle in certain ideas. And I mean, I feel like I did that a lot, right? I would say, well, you know, Johnny Depp could be telling the truth or he could be lying. And I was always trying to get out ahead of certain people thinking I'm saying something when that's not really what I mean. But I don't think I did this enough. And you're probably right, anonymous patron, that I should have said something like, so I'm providing a compassionate, understanding point of view for people with borderline. But I want to be clear, if you have someone in your life that had borderline or has borderline and had or is abusing you, by no means am I saying that they were justified in doing that. And by no means am I saying you're supposed to have compassion for them, because you don't have to have compassion for your abuser if you don't want to. You could hate them your whole life and that's okay. I'm not saying you're supposed to somehow just not have anger and not draw distance. And you know, people would even email in and say, my mother is abusive and has been diagnosed with borderline, and from your episodes, I feel a new compassion towards her, and I feel kind of like I should forgive her or I should be nice to her. Is that what you're saying? And I'd be like, no. If someone's being abusive to you, get away. Do everything in your power to get away from them. You deserve that. You do not ever deserve to be abused, regardless of the reason. Even if you understand, or I'm proposing, that your abuser went through abuse themselves and that's why they're doing that, that in no way justifies what's happening. And in no way means that you somehow have to, I don't know, see them in a positive light. No, get away from them. That's what I do. I'm an expert on this. I will detect people like this in my personal life, and I'll try to make it work, but past a certain threshold, I'm gone. And I feel bad about that, but that's what I do, because I'll try to make it work, and it I end up being harmed tremendously, and then I get out. So everyone deserves to get away from an abusive person, even if we can see the abuser as sympathetic and as having viable psychological reasons as to why they're doing that. But by no means does that mean you're supposed to stick around. No. All right. This next series of were comments on Patreon, and I am going to read those now. I'm not going to read their names because I never know if people want to remain anonymous in that situation, because it is often behind that paywall. But so I'll just label them all as Patreon members. And this first Patreon member was attacking me or criticizing me harshly, very harshly, for the things that I was saying. And I think this person was pro Amber Heard and provided a lot of Reddit threads that they wanted me to look at that were, you know, hundreds of people on Reddit were attacking me and saying that I was awful and harmful and unethical. And, you know, it was one of those situations. So they were directing me to that Reddit thread. And then they say, I think your videos are doing more damage to many more of your deserving listeners than you realize. Which, and I've already been over, that's completely mortifying to me. Even if it's misplaced, the fact that some longtime listeners feel harmed by me is just awful, truly. And, I mean, I guess the only kind of justification I can say for taking that risk is I guess I felt through this whole thing that there's a lot of good that I can do. And but I don't know if it justifies that risk that I took. Another Patreon member was commenting on the same thread and said, "I do not have words to express the sadness and disappointment your coverage of this trial has caused me. Nothing about your perspective or choices feels safe. Sadly, it was quite a repeat lesson for me of knowing your profession is not safe, kind, one to be trusted, one of insight or compassion. I am so grateful a Patreon member posted their Reddit thread where over 200 have upvoted their support of this view." Yeah, I mean, it's just more pain for me and I guess pain for you, which is awful. Another Patreon member also commented and said, "I respectfully disagree. I have been on those Reddit boards. I have watched the Borderline Personality Disorder subreddit refuse to post Amber Heard content, and I've seen the Borderline Personality Disorder loved ones sub feel heard because of the trial. This podcast is by far the most objective source I've found online that explains both sides. Don't you remember halfway through when Kirk shifted to saying we should consider taking Amber at her word? There was also room for Johnny Depp being an abuser. That Reddit post alludes to not going to therapy again because of Kirk. How is that not textbook catastrophizing and black and white thinking?" Yeah, well, thanks for saying that. I am mortified that anyone would not go to therapy because of me. I mean, again, just like, that's probably even the worst thing anyone could ever say to me, right? It's one thing to say you're harmful. It's another thing to prevent someone from going to therapy, to prevent someone from seeking the help that they deserve. I mean, if I could say one thing to those people, I would say there are plenty of therapists that also probably think I'm an idiot. So find one of them, because they would probably agree with you that I'm an idiot or something. You know, you deserve to get the help that you need. So I hope that you would never not go to therapy because some rando on YouTube said something. Another Patreon member was disagreeing as well to the criticism against me and says, "I'm not sure if we're watching the same videos because I haven't gotten any of that from anything Dr. Honda said. Like you, I'm also a survivor. In my opinion, your comment sounds a bit threatening near the end. I remember being threatened countless times, and it was never a good feeling. Please try to remember every time threats were made against you and how they affected you. I don't mean any disrespect to you." Yeah, so thanks for sticking up for me. I don't want anyone to feel compelled to fight my battle, but I do absolutely appreciate when people just provide a respectful rebuttal. Just be like, "Hey, you know, I don't mean to be respectful, or I hear where you're coming from, but that's not how I took it." You know, something like that. I think one, makes me feel better, and two, your voice deserves to be heard, and three, might help other people a little bit to be like, "Oh, well, maybe I should." I mean, people can turn away from me, they could cancel their membership, they could, you know, walk away and think I'm an idiot, but at the very least, I wouldn't want them to think that therapy is bad or think that they shouldn't go to therapy because of me or something. So maybe offering those kinds of kind rebuttals would help people a little bit. I don't know. Patron Annabelle had some nice things to say that I won't mention because it feels indulgent going on. "Apparently, I've been struggling with symptoms of a personality disorder, but never had the language, tools, or skills to express my experience or to get help. You changed that. The kindness, compassion, and expertise you share so generously altered the course of my life, as well as the lives of my family members. I'm now in therapy through BetterHelp, where I found a lovely therapist. As long as I am able, I'll continue to support your work. Keep your chins up, and thank you again for all you do." Well, thank you. Are you saying I have multiple chins? Narcissism! Anyway, but yeah, glad that you got help, and BetterHelp is one of the options. It's a convenient option, but there are other options, obviously. And you found a lovely therapist. That's great. And in terms of, you know, some people will say, like, "I can't afford to be a patron member. I hope that's okay." And yeah, absolutely. I can relate. There have been vast swaths of my life where paying $5 a month was not affordable to me. So I get that. I 100% do. When you download my podcast on your phone app or you click on YouTube, you are contributing to, you know, the fractions of the pennies that come my way, and it adds up. So you are contributing when you're watching, for sure. And honestly, that was always my hope from the very beginning. You know, before Patreon came along, I was podcasting 7 years before Patreon was invented. And I remember thinking, well, okay, I have like 1,000 people that are listening to the podcast, or I don't know, whatever number. And I thought, if everyone just gave $1 a month, then I could make a living doing this or something like that. I mean, not on that salary in all likelihood, but in Seattle anyway, but something along those lines. And I remember thinking, I wish there was a way that everyone could just, every time they listened, they, you know, it's like someone singing a song on the corner and you put a nickel in their cup. And it's just a little contribution. You know, if everyone gives a little bit, then I can actually dedicate more time to this sort of thing. And so with clicking and the ads that you have to sit through or listen to, those are essentially not a nickel. It would be nice, but it's a, you know, a small fraction of a penny, but it adds up. And so you are doing that for me. And while I'm on that topic, I mean, just think about it. Like you, all of you right now are literally paying my bills so that I can do this. You bought the camera. I'm talking, well, actually my wife bought that camera. Did y'all know I'm using her camera? She has a lot of cameras, not a lot of cameras, but some. This whole time I've been using her camera. this microphone I bought a long time ago, but you know, this computer screen I probably bought at some point during the podcast. And so you bought the computer screen. What else did you buy? A lot of things. Probably this shirt. I bought this shirt in the past couple of years. You bought this shirt. You paid for my haircut, which is, I don't know. Anyway, so you did that. Because you did that, that means I didn't have to do other things to have them pay for those things so that I could do this right now. All right. Listener from Bermuda, she says, I'm a longtime follower of your YouTube channel, and I am devastated to hear about your experience with online backlash. I wanted to share how much of a positive impact your work has had on my life. I was so ashamed to find that I could relate a lot to Amber Heard's behavior. In my current relationship, I have become the abusive partner. I have punched walls, slammed doors, screamed, stomped out of rooms, and used painful details of my partner's personal life like daggers against him during our fights. While the whole world seemed to be painting Amber as a psychotic demon spawn, I stayed quiet because I was so ashamed to admit that I could understand where she was coming from, and I just assumed that I was also evil, the way that they were talking about Amber Heard. Your compassionate and balanced approach to her testimony made me realize that there are some safe spaces where I can confront this part of myself and work on it to keep him safe and make our life together better. I don't think I ever would have had the courage to admit this to anyone else if I hadn't seen your analysis of the trial. I started online therapy at the beginning of June with a clear goal of addressing this issue, and my partner is willing to start couples therapy. So I want to thank you. Your safety and well-being should be of the utmost priority, and I really hope that you and your family stay well. Well, listener from Bermuda, I mean, my goodness. You know, it's one thing, which is glorious, when someone who has borderline or histrionic or is an abuse survivor themselves listens to my stuff and feels validated and gets the help that they need. But it's a whole other thing. Well, let's just say it's equally as wonderful and gratifying when someone who is abusive watches my stuff and is able to admit to themselves that they also are being abusive, but that doesn't mean that they're an evil human being and thus can accept their behavior and look at it, admit to it, and get the help that they need such that they don't do that anymore, so that they don't harm their partner and they can actually get their needs met. I mean, my goodness, I want to hug this email. I just want to, I feel like I want to cry. Hold it together, Kirk. All right. All right, well, let's end it there, and then I'll pick up later in another episode. And everyone out there, please take care of yourself, because you deserve it. You really, really do.